it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at a given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes.
Let's arrest them. Let's have them go before a jury of his peers.
Yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, because I like Esther's, her list of demands. They kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on the momentum that we have here, and definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. We do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat on around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV. Because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes. And it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story. And it was just like, wow, I still can't believe this happened. The case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Gardner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
You know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about color blindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
There's police officers in riot here trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Over the last decade, the global wind power market has almost quadrupled, but as the industry has grown, the turbines have too. According to CNBC, several original equipment manufacturers, or OEMs, announced plans to develop new large-scale turbines for the offshore sector, and the size of these new machines is considerable. We are prepared for an article written by Dave Makichuk. The piece is titled Monster Wind Farms Are About to Get Bigger. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Dave Makichuk's article. Monsters are ready to take over the windy landscape of Europe, and we're not talking about King Kong or Godzilla, although that would be cool. We're talking about giant-sized billion-dollar wind farms capable of powering millions of homes. According to CNBC, quoting a recent report from the Global Wind Energy Council, the sector installed 93 gigawatts of new capacity in 2020, a record figure which represents a year-on-year jump of more than 50%. Over the last decade, the global wind power market has almost quadrupled. But as the industry has grown, the turbines have too. According to CNBC, several original equipment manufacturers, or OEMs, announced plans to develop new large-scale turbines for the offshore sector, and the size of these new machines is considerable. For example, GE Renewable Energy's Haliade X turbine will have a tip height of 260 meters or 853 feet, 107 meter long blades, and a 220 meter rotor. Its capacity will be able to be configured to 12, 13, or 14 megawatts. A prototype of the Haliade X in the Netherlands has a tip height of 248 meters. Details of GE's Haliade X were released in March of 2018. In the years since, other big players in the sector, such as Vestas and Siemens, Gamesa Renewable Energy, or SGRE, have rolled out designs for similarly huge turbines. Barla, a principal analyst at Wood Mackenzie, told CNBC, "You could see a quantum leap in the technology architecture and the technology specifications on the turbines." Competition within the sector is certainly heating up. In February, Vestas revealed plans for a 15-megawatt turbine. It wants to install a prototype in 2022 and expand production in 2024. For its part, the Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy, SGRE, is working on a 14-megawatt model, the SG14222DD, which can also be boosted to 15 megawatts if required. Again, the dimensions of these turbines are big. The Vestas turbine will have a blade length of 115.5 meters and a rotor diameter of 236 meters. GRE's design incorporates 108 meter blades and a rotor diameter of 222 meters. The size and scope of these new designs may be impressive, but they have a practical purpose too. For instance, when it comes to height, a taller turbine can harness faster wind speeds and produce more electricity. Rotor size is also crucial, a point Wood Mackenzie's Bala was keen to make. He argued increasing the diameter of a turbine's rotor has a bigger impact than boosting its height, because the swept area is increasing, and if the swept area is increasing, then you're harnessing more energy. Spain's REVE reported the potential downside, of course, is the environmental impact of these larger turbine blades on local birds and bat populations. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, between 140,000 and 500,000 bird deaths occurred at wind farms each year. Wind turbines have also been found to be one of the leading causes of mass bat mortality, with some studies pinning fatalities at 888,000 bats a year. Unlike previous years, wind energy companies are now responsible for completing environmental impact assessments, or EIAs, prior to the installation of wind turbines in an area. Bird migratory routes are avoided, and vegetation surveys are conducted underneath turbines to ensure that none of the migratory birds' preferred food sources are present. According to REVE in Spain, some wind energy companies even shut down wind farms when large numbers of migrating birds approach. A 2019 study describes mitigation measures involving tilling the soil around the base of wind turbines, making the area less attractive to kestrels due to the consequent reduction of prey around the turbines. The result? A 75 to 100% decline in collisions over a period of 2 years. Even more recently, Norwegian scientists have discovered that painting one of the three blades on a wind turbine black reduces avian deaths by 72%. Scientists believe once a blade is painted black, the birds correctly distinguish the motion patterns as a moving object.
A museum in London has transformed its gift shop into a mini supermarket selling artist-designed food to help an industry largely affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The Design Museum has reopened its shop with the help of 10 artists. It sells essential products with packaging designed by emerging artists. The market offers goods at the same price of normal markets, both online and at a marketplace. The initiative is led by Camille Walala, who says her project is aimed at supporting the artists reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the project is to support artists, and I think because obviously at the moment there's no exhibition, people can't really show any of their creative work, and it's nice to have like a feedback when you're creative. It's nice to know, you know, if people like your work. I think this is a really nice platform to just bring artwork on like everyday product, and actually people are going to probably come and just buy them and probably keep them as a piece of art, like, you know, an affordable piece of art from some artists that you like. I think it's a really nice way to display art, so yeah, I think.
Walala says the project also conveys the message that creativity is as important for living as the other essentials. She says the creative supermarket will also help the museum, which has seen a drop of more than 90% in income because of the pandemic. The shop is open for just 5 days, but artists expect heavy demand. In Hong Kong schools, robots are helping children with autism to live a better life. These robots are part of an educational program called Robot for Autism Behavioral Intervention, or RABI. It's designed for individuals with autism between 3 and 18 years of age and aims to make them more social. The robots engage the children with role-playing and verbal interaction, helping them to resolve issues such as conflicts and bullying. The program was developed by a Hong Kong professor, Catherine So. She says the program will help fight social deprivation of a certain group of people.
We would believe that RABI can help them to, you know, improve their social and behavioral skills and in turn enhancing their quality of their life. So to reduce being excluded in the society and also help them to be included in the future.
Catherine says using robots also helps keep the program structured and predictable, as autistic people are hypersensitive to voices and facial expressions. The program she launched in 2015 has now been adopted in more than 20 nonprofit groups and public schools in the country. More than 1,200 children have used it so far.
Worldwide trends show people rapidly moving toward modern vehicles now, especially electric cars. But Parisians saw a very unusual kind of EV driving around the city, similar to the one people were using over a century ago. A replica of the 1881 vehicle by French inventor Gustave Trouve was made to celebrate what is regarded as the 140th anniversary of the first viable electric car. Trouve, who is believed to have driven the world's first electric car, combined a rechargeable battery and a cycle, something very similar to a modern e-bike. The car has a motor to assist you, but you can still pedal at the same time.
So Gustave Trouve, when he combined an electric motor, a rechargeable battery and a cycle very similar to this one, that would be one of the earliest, if not the earliest, electric vehicle to be seen on the roads.
A Victorian cycle engineer built the vehicle in North Yorkshire, England. It took him some 2 months to come up with the replica, with materials that closely matched those used by Trouve himself. Like the original, it has an average speed of approximately 16 kilometres per hour. NASA's small helicopter has made history as it successfully completed its flight on Mars. Receiving instructions from Earth, Ingenuity managed to rise to about 3 meters, hovered for 30 seconds, and then landed on the red planet. The mission marked the first powered, controlled flight on another planet. The helicopter weighs only 1.8 kilograms, has four legs, and is powered by solar panels. Flying a helicopter on Mars is hard because there is not much air to push against to generate the necessary lift. A creative artist in Belgium has come up with an alternative to the face masks, a portable oasis. Alain Vercheron says the mini greenhouse allows him to connect with people while observing social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic. However, the idea is not new. It came to his mind 15 years ago, inspired by the lush oasis he encountered while working in Tunisia.
An oasis is a place of calm, tranquility, cool and well-being in the deserts. Here, the fact of having an oasis containing medicinal plants means I am also protecting myself from harm coming from the outside, just like I could at an oasis in the middle of the desert.
Doesn't that look bizarre? Well, he says he has asthma, and breathing with the device is easier than a face mask. The 61-year-old artist hopes his invention also raises awareness of environment protection. Pumas are solitary animals that do not usually get along well with humans. However, a Russian family has been living with an extraordinarily friendly mountain lion for 5 years. Now, Alexander and Maria Dmitriev bought little Messi from a zoo 5 years ago. The cat could barely walk then. With the tender care of the couple, he soon regained his strength. Messi's growth was stunted due to his malnutrition. Interestingly, the adorable puma has never shown any aggression toward humans. Well, looks very friendly. Messi's family has converted their home to meet his natural needs. They have also set up social media accounts for him on Instagram and YouTube, where he has millions of followers.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Malaysian farmers tap classical music and massages to grow one of the world's most expensive fruits, Japanese muskmelons. The farmers believe the method is the best way to grow Japanese muskmelons in Malaysia's hot tropical weather. They regularly rub the melons with a soft cloth or glove. That's a practice, the farmers say, enhance the melon's flavor. To stimulate their growth, classical music is played in greenhouses, and now all these efforts have paid off following constant trials. The farmers are finally selling their prized luxury fruits of labor on the market.
April is usually marked by multi-day festivities across much of Southeast Asia, including Myanmar, as they observe the Buddhist New Year. The traditional New Year in Myanmar this year began on Tuesday with five-day celebrations known as Tengon. The occasion is usually celebrated with prayers, ritual cleaning of Buddha images in temples, and public water splashing on the streets. They think water can wash their souls and all evil deeds. People also flock to temples with traditional pots containing flowers and receive blessing from monks. But typically, joyous period of celebration is looking very different this year amid coronavirus and political crises in Myanmar.
A dozen lucky penguins have been returned to the wild after rehabilitating from malnutrition and anemia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Argentina. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists. Some of them had lost their plumage due to malnutrition, but they recovered their feathers after receiving special nutrients. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after a Portuguese explorer, Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile. People in Britain are marking the easing of lockdowns implemented to curb the coronavirus pandemic. Words like freedom, hope, family, reunion, and relief have been projected on the walls of the UK's most iconic landmarks, as well as shops and department stores, to show people's feelings. A British company commissioned a survey to find the words that best summed up people's feeling after months of lockdown began to be lifted on Monday. Those celebrating the event say reunion is the word that can best express their feelings.
The most powerful word in there for me is reunion. We've all been apart from each other, friends, loved ones, colleagues, who are also loved ones, I suppose, in some cases, and really looking forward to getting back to my friends and family that I haven't seen for a long time, and imagine a lot of the British public are too.
The event comes as the UK has been the worst hit nation with a pandemic across Europe. The country saw a staggering number of infections and deaths for months. This prompted authorities to impose restrictions in an effort to bring the pandemic under control.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Carbon dioxide emissions are forecast to jump this year by the second biggest annual rise in history, as global economies pour stimulus cash into fossil fuels in the recovery from the COVID-19 recession. The leap will be second only to the massive rebound 10 years ago after the financial crisis, and will put climate hopes out of reach unless governments act quickly, the International Energy Agency, IEA, has warned. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Carbon Emissions to Soar in 2021 by Second Highest Rate in History. Stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. Carbon dioxide emissions are forecast to jump this year by the second biggest annual rise in history, as global economies pour stimulus cash into fossil fuels in the recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic and recession. The leap will be the second only to the massive rebound 10 years ago after the financial crisis, and will put climate hopes out of reach unless governments act quickly, the International Energy Agency has warned. Surging use of coal, the dirtiest fossil fuel for electricity, is largely driving the emissions rise, especially across Asia, but also in the United States. Coal's rebound causes particular concern because it comes despite plunging prices for renewable energy, which is now cheaper than coal. Speaking in an interview with The Guardian, Fatih Birol, the executive director of the International Energy Agency and one of the world's leading authorities on energy and climate, said, This is shocking and very disturbing. On the one hand, governments today are saying climate change is their priority. But on the other hand, we're seeing the second biggest emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, rise in history. It is really disappointing. Carbon dioxide emissions need to be cut by 45% this decade if the world is to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, scientists have warned. That means the 2020s must be the decade when the world changes course before the level of carbon in the atmosphere rises too high to avoid dangerous levels of heating. But the scale of the current emissions rebound from the COVID-19 crisis means our starting point is definitely not a good one, said Fateh Birol. Birol compared the current surge of carbon dioxide emissions to the financial crisis, when emissions rose by more than 6% in 2010 after countries tried to stimulate their economies through cheap fossil fuel energy. It seems we are back on course to repeat the same mistakes, he warned. I am more disappointed this time round than in 2010. Carbon dioxide emissions plunged by a record 7% globally last year, owing to the lockdowns that followed the COVID-19 pandemic. But by the end of the year, they were already rebounding and on track to exceed 2019 levels in some areas. The International Energy Agency projections for 2021 show carbon dioxide emissions are likely to end this year still down slightly on 2019 levels, but on a rising path. Next year, there could be even stronger rises as air travel returns, Fateh Birol added. Aviation would normally contribute more than 2% of global emissions, but has been almost absent this past year. He called on governments to bring forward new climate policies urgently and seek a green recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. Last year, I expressed my hope that the economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic should be green and sustainable. But these numbers indicate that this recovery is currently anything but sustainable for our climate, he said. The US President Joe Biden is convening a climate summit this week, with the leaders of 40 countries expected to attend, at which Biden will urge countries to come forward with strong commitments on cutting carbon dioxide emissions this decade. Fateh Birol said this was an opportunity for countries to change course and put policies in place for a green recovery. Birol added, if governments take clear and imminent action, with the amount of cheap, clean energy technologies we have, we can transform this disappointment to some good outcomes. The International Energy Agency, IEA, is considered the global gold standard for energy data, and its projections for 2021 are based on comprehensive soundings from around the world, including data from existing energy sources and new plants scheduled to come on stream. Energy data from the end of last year showed fossil fuels ahead of 2019 levels, and the surge has continued in the first part of this year. In its Global Energy Review, published on Tuesday, 20th of April, the International Energy Agency found that global carbon emissions from energy use, which accounts for the great majority of greenhouse gas emissions, were on course to rise by 1.5 billion tons in 2021, after having fallen last year. That represents a 5% rise to 33 billion tons of carbon dioxide for the year. After more than half a decade of decline, global coal demand is forecast to grow by 4.5%, approaching its all-time peak in 2014. China is planning to build scores of coal-fired power stations, despite pledging last year to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2060. The country's five-year economic plan, set out by Beijing last month, contained little detail on curbing carbon emissions before 2030. However, after a surprise visit to Shanghai by the U.S. climate envoy John Kerry, the United States and China pledged cooperation on greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade. Coal use is also surging in the United States, reversing annual declines since 2013. Fatih Birol said this was the result of high gas prices, which are driving a switch from gas to coal for electricity generation. Former U.S. President Donald Trump scrapped regulations put in place by his predecessor Barack Obama to curb coal use by power stations. Joe Biden is considering further measures to hasten the move to renewable energy. Nicholas Stern, a climate economist and the chair of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change at the London School of Economics, said the International Energy Agency findings show that countries really must act with greater urgency to accelerate the transition to zero carbon pathways if we are to have a chance of emissions being reduced in line with the Paris Climate Accord. This is a crucial and historic opportunity to build back differently from the polluting ways of the past, and in particular to move much more quickly away from coal. A strong and sustainable economic recovery will come from less coal and not more.
Around the World with Reporters.
A fight for survival is what kidney failure patients in Yemen face as a result of the ongoing war and siege by the Saudi-led coalition. Many dialysis centers had to stop providing services due to a lack of fuel and necessary medical equipment. Therefore, the only dialysis center in Hodeidah in western Yemen struggles to cope with the large number of patients.
The center provides health services to approximately 470 patients per week, and the number is likely to increase as we receive patients from other cities, and this exceeds the capacity of our center. So we may have to decrease the number of sessions allocated to each patient. We also suffer from a shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the continued Saudi blockade in our country.
Patients say lack of fuel worsens their suffering as they come from far areas twice a week and they can't afford the rising cost of transportation. Salim is one of them. He says he takes hours to get to the center due to the military confrontations on the main roads.
I live in an area half an hour away from the center, but the main road is closed due to the continuing military confrontations. So we have to take another road. It takes 2 hours. High fuel prices are also a major problem for us. We cannot afford the rising transportation costs.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to return the former president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. The brutal aggression has killed over 100,000 of civilians, most of them women and children. Hundreds of kidney failure patients may lose their lives if this center stops providing its services. However, as the people here say, the international community remains silent towards their sufferings. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Hodeidah.
The weather has been improving in the EU as we edge closer to summer, but airports remain virtually empty and the bloc's tourism sector is on its knees. EU legislators say there is no coordination.
Some member states asking 7 days of quarantine, some five, some requesting a type of test, some not. Greece taking away quarantine and so on and so on and so on.
Conflicting vaccination strategies are adding to the confusion for citizens.
There are restrictions in various member states, and maybe in terms of age or gender, or some states not using AstraZeneca at all, and I'm fear that that may be reflected as well in the Johnson & Johnson availability.
The European Commission has set a target to see two-thirds of EU citizens vaccinated by the 1st of September, but things aren't going well.
Only 8% have both inoculations needed. What is being done to reach the 70% target in the next 4 months?
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides prefers to talk about vaccines ordered rather than vaccines administered.
About 300 million doses of vaccines.
When signing new contracts with suppliers, EU lawmakers are calling for less secrecy.
Please also make sure that this time the contracts can be available. The Commission is always saying we want it, but we can't because of the companies. Make sure you're not bound by it in the next contract.
Slow vaccination rollout means new variants might emerge. Also, millions of businesses must remain closed.
The European Trade Union Confederation warns youth unemployment in the EU is set to rise by 70%, that's 7-0, unless drastic measures are taken by governments and institutions.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, is painting a gloomy picture.
The near-term economic outlook remains clouded by uncertainty about the resurgence of the pandemic and the rollout of vaccination campaigns.
In the EU, people out of work for more than 12 months are classified as long-term unemployed.
A crisis this deep has generated a huge number of long-term unemployed, and that may be a problem as the economy picks up.
Lawmakers and the European Central Bank are calling on EU leaders to speed up the delivery of financial support. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The funeral of a 59-year-old woman, and only her close relatives are performing the last rites. Her family says she didn't die of the coronavirus, but due to lack of space in the hospital. The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic has brought the country's healthcare on the brink of collapse as hospitals struggle with lack of resources and space. The country is battling with lack of oxygen supplies and spaces to cremate the dead ones.
We are running out of space here. We have cremated around 40 bodies since morning. This is crisis. We are tired and overwhelmed.
Just a mile away from the crematorium, a truck loaded with oxygen cylinders is preparing a delivery to some nearby hospitals, with police protection, as oxygen tankers and cylinders are being looted in some parts of the country. This truck loader says we are working 24/7 to deliver as much as we can. So are the ambulance drivers.
This is war, not a pandemic. We are restless. We are running out of ambulances and oxygen supplies. But we are trying our best to save lives.
On Friday, India reported over 330,000 fresh cases of coronavirus, which is the highest daily increase the country has recorded so far. Over 2,200 deaths were also reported across the country, with the state of Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh, New Delhi and Madhya Pradesh being the worst affected. The country has recorded 15 million cases so far and more than 184,000 deaths. Health experts say the unprecedented second wave could be blamed on a double mutant variant strains and recent religious gatherings and election campaigns, which has brought the healthcare to a breaking point.
India's coronavirus crisis is deepening further with each passing day, and the country is in a grip of a devastating second wave of the virus. Many unforeseen issues are cropping up and severely hampering the country's fight against the virus. Health experts believe the country's health system is on the verge of collapse, blaming the government's unpreparedness and failed policies for the country's failure to tackle the second wave. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
No one eats or drinks anything during the day. Restaurants and bakeries are all closed. This is not neither because of threats or the COVID-19 pandemic. What has created such an atmosphere across Afghanistan comes from a religious belief that prohibits Muslims from drinking and eating under the name of fasting. Ramadan is the name for one of the holiest Islamic months and is the ninth month in the Islamic lunar calendar. The rising of the sun marks the beginning of fasting and Muslims are allowed to break it after sunset. Now let's see how Afghans break their fasts when the sun sets. The approval for every Muslim to break their fast is Azan-e-Maghrib, or the call for the sunset prayer. That is why almost all Muslims first do their sunset prayers before breaking their fast, which is called iftar. However, iftar time is a specific time for Afghans, as they traditionally and religiously get together at their homes or at restaurants. The gatherings are called iftari. There are special dishes and drinks in the Afghan food culture for iftari.
Iftar time is very important to our people. We prepare some special dishes and drinks for iftar, such as luk, tea, fresh juices, and some local dishes, including bolani, sambasa, ashak, manto, qabeli, and kebab.
Many here also see the fasting month of Ramadan as a time for boosting their family relations and social ties by inviting others for iftari.
We have many traditions and customs to mark the holy month of Ramadan. For instance, most of us use Ramadan as an opportunity to invite others for iftari. This is based on our religious and traditional beliefs that, of course, strengthen our social ties.
In the meantime, there are also poor people who are in urgent need of food and shelter during the holy month of Ramadan. Our religion teachings urge Muslims to support them as part of duties of a fasting Muslim. Therefore, some individuals and charity groups set up food distribution programs for poor families during the holy month. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
COVID-1 vaccine was proved safe during the first phase of the human trials. And now the second stage suggests it also provides effective immunity against the coronavirus. Produced by the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, COVID-1 was injected to 280 volunteers in the second clinical stage. And the results were reported to the health ministry.
We passed the first and second clinical stages, and in the next 2 days, we will report the results of the second phase to the regulatory bodies. So far, we have achieved promising results as to the efficiency of the vaccine. Once this phase is complete, we can then speak with certainty about the exact percentage of the vaccine's efficiency.
Once the second phase is over and the vaccine is proved effective against the coronavirus, the third and final stage will then be initiated, which involves giving the jabs to 20,000 volunteers. COVID-1 authorities say they have already issued the call for voluntary injections since time is running short.
Based on international standards, if a vaccine gives at least 50% immunity against the virus, it is viable and can be mass-produced. We are confident from our lab tests that Coviran is effective and can generate significant number of antibodies, so we have already issued a call for volunteers to study its efficacy on a larger statistical population.
The first phase of the clinical trial was carried out in December last year, which proved that the vaccine is safe and will not cause any side effects. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, including Covpars, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V.
Coviran is already ahead in the race compared to other Iranian local vaccines. Now as the fourth wave of the pandemic is sweeping the country, Coviran developers say they're making their utmost efforts to get their jabs to the market within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.